It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Hale Irwin's professional career. Bruce mentioned some of this in the intro, but 83 professional wins, including 20 PGA Tour victories, 3 wins on the European Tour, 45, which is the all-time record, senior PGA Tour wins. The highest world ranking was 7th in 1991, but he was in the top 5 in Mark McCormick's rankings each year from 1975 through 1979. One of only 5 players to win on 6 continents, so he was clearly a global player, as were people like Bruce Devlin, Gary Player, David Graham, Bernard Langer, Justin Rose, just to name a few. He made 86 straight cuts on the tour from January of 75 to the end of the 1978 season. That's 4th all-time, which is just an astounding accomplishment. On the tour itself, 3 majors. We'll talk about the Open wins, U.S. Open wins in 1974, 79, and 1990. And there are a whole bunch of other wins, as we mentioned. And I thought what we would do, just with the time we've got, Hale, is why don't we just jump right to the majors first and get to the good stuff. We can start with the U.S. Open and then ask you to reflect on your experiences at some of the other majors. But let's just go, if we can, right to the U.S. Open, where you had 34 starts. You had 27 cuts made of those 34 starts, 5 top fives, 7 top tens, 13 top 25s. And, of course, you got 3 wins, but you've got one or two other close calls you'd probably want to reflect on as well, wouldn't you?
You know, Mike, maybe it's just me, but I remember the wins, and whether I finished 2nd or 102nd didn't matter to me.
That's pretty consistent, you know, across other guests as well.
Winning was the name of the game. In fact, I kind of make this little comparison. You take the name Irwin.
I like it.
You know, to say that you finished, you had so many top 25s, so what? It may be a great statistic, but believe me, when I left town, I was, oh man, did I play great. I had a top 25 this week.
Look what I got.
Boy, that was, but I think I'm going to go back just a little bit because, you know, you jump right to the Open, but I think winning your first event is such a career boosting, confidence boosting accomplishment. Bruce, you know what I'm talking about. You win that first event as a professional, and I can remember that down at Sea Pines at the Heritage. It was a tough little golf course at the time, and to win there, I felt I didn't need an airplane to get off of that island.
You were flying high, baby.
So I think those wins help win other events. Now you can go forward to the U.S. Open event. I won. That was 71, and I won the same tournament again in 73. So it wasn't like I hadn't won before. But unless you're in the mix at a major championship, you really don't know what it's about, because they can be career-altering both ways. Because we've seen guys win a career major and they disappear from the scene. So you have to build upon that. But I think it really helps set the tone for having had some experience before. Orville Moody, Bruce, we see he wins one tournament on the tour, and it was a U.S. Open. How do you figure that one? So
you see a guy like Hale Irwin winning at Harbortown, knowing the golf course as people do, it's not surprising that someone that would have success in a U.S. Open would probably likely have some success there. It's a tough golf course. You got to position your tee shot well. You got to shape your ball. It's tough today, by the way, if you haven't played it lately. It's a hard, hard course, and you won there 3 times, didn't you?
I did, 71, 73, and 94.
And I'll talk about one close call you had, and that was in 81, because you and Bruce, I think, both finished 2nd in 81 to a very hot Bill Rogers that year.
Oh, yeah, Bill had a great year that year. He played well. I think he won the Open Championship that year.
To Royal St. George's?
Yeah. He just played that little fade out there, and he had that old mallet putter, and he just put the ball in the hole every time. He played fantastic golf that year.
Yeah, hard to believe. It's 40 years ago. We talked to him, actually released his episode the week of Open Championship week when it was at Royal St. George's, and he got a kick out of that, just reliving those memories. So you're right. You win a couple of times at Harbortown, and next thing you know, you're at Wingfoot for the 1974 U.S. Open. Maybe the bad news for you guys that had to play in that was the year after Johnny Miller tore up Oakmont. So they had it. It looks like they had it in for you that year with setup.
I'm going to cut across half here. I want to tell you something. That's the hardest damn golf course I ever played in my life.
I agree. I tell people without weather being an issue, you know, without wind and rain and all the nastiness that weather can bring, it was easily the hardest golf course. Just first tee to first green and trying to get in with it was without the grass eating your shoes.
Yeah. Well, and it's very, Hale mentioned about, you know, attitudes of people that he used to watch. I got to tell you something from an attitude standpoint, and he said it about himself earlier about the fact that you're not going to outwork him. You know, that was very typical, I thought, Hale, of your whole career was the fact that, you know, you don't win 83 golf tournaments if you quit halfway through. It's just not going to happen. So, kudos for you for all those great victories.
Well, as you well know, they don't come easily, and it's more than skill. You've got to have that something. And the difference between guys that get on the tour or women, it doesn't matter. They all can hit a golf ball. That's not the barometer. It's what do you do with the brain and the heart? How do they connect? And then how does it transform itself into confidence and the ability to go put the ball in the hole? And we see so many young people come out that can't miss, have that can't miss label. Then they get out there and they run into the Bruce Devlins of the world. They come home and cry to mama and papa, I didn't make it. Well, I wonder why. Because maybe that's all they ever did. They're too cajoled.
So take us through that week that you had back in 1974. Of course, this was at Wingfoot. Difficult course setup, as you guys mentioned, coming off the 63 that Johnny Miller had finished with at Oakmont the prior year. You won by two over Forrest Fesler at 7 over. Dick Schapp, a famous sports caster and writer, I think maybe first described it as the massacre at Wingfoot because of that brutal setup. But Sandy Tatum, he sort of denies that had anything to do with the setup that week.
Yeah, I believe that, don't you, Bruce?
Yeah, sure I do. Yeah. Tell me another stories.
Well,
oh boy,
take us back to that week.
Well, I think they started for me. I've played well the week before in Philadelphia. I don't know if I finished second or third or whatever. I had one of those top fives or tens, whatever. But anyway, so on the car up to drove with Leonard Thompson up to Wingfoot. And the moment I stepped foot on Wingfoot and played that golf course and came in back to the locker room, the doom and gloom in the locker room was unbelievable. Of course, now after day two, it is even thicker. So I can remember thinking, you know, all you have to do is beat about a third of the field because the other two thirds have given up. They've checked out. And you put it in the simplest terms and trying to say, okay, I don't have all these guys to beat now. I've got that golf course to beat. And then you got the Nicholases and the people like that, certainly. But more than anything, you better have yourself to fall back on because no one else is going to catch you this week.
Yeah. So an example of what you're talking about, I guess the first round average was about 78. No one broke par that first day, did they?
I'm surprised anybody could get close to par, but I just remember the rough being so long, and of course Jack he four putts the first green and knocks it right off the putting surface, makes a double bogey, and you know how quick the word spread on the golf course about that one. Wow! So you don't find the world's best player four putting the first green without it being difficult, and that was back. in 74, and let's put it correctly, the environment in which most superintendents found themselves, they didn't have the money. Most of the clubs didn't put the money in. These people now are scientists. They are engineers. They are the most knowledgeable people. They just don't grow grass. They don't water the ground and grass grows. These people really know how to develop turf. Well, this was a little bit prior to that, but they had done a superb job on getting Wingfoot ready for that Open Championship. And of course, the rough just happened to get long for no other reason. It just did it all by itself. I'm sure that's what happened.
Sandy assured us of that.
That's okay. You know, that's okay. If you hit it in a rough, unlike today's, you know, hit it wherever you want to, 350 yards and gouge it out onto the green, I think it puts a premium on putting the ball in play and playing shots and playing the golf course, not overwhelming the golf course.
So you were one back after 54 with Tom Watson being the leader. You two guys played the final round together, I believe, right?
We did.
And Tom was fairly young, 24 or so at the time?
He was. And you know, I remember thinking, I think Arnie was up there pretty high. And in my mind, I'm kind of going through, okay, we've got Tom and he's young. He's hitting it a little too wild, missing too many fairways. Not that he can't win, but he said, okay, he's got his own issues. Arnie, and I don't know why I was thinking this. Arnie's getting too old. He's not going to. You know, I just kind of, in my own mind, I built this case up where I've got a heck of a chance if I don't do something stupid.
Yeah.
Well, I made a nice putt at number 9 from about, I don't know, 30 feet, I guess, up over a ridge and for a birdie, which was a birdie on a par 5 hole that was converted to a 4. If you remember, they moved the tee up about 3 yards and said, okay, now it's a par 4. But I'd hit a 4-wood to that green, and I made a nice putt, and I took the lead there. But then I had several bogeys on the back 9, and it was just hard to get in. Everybody was struggling to get in.
So what's it feel like with a 2-shot lead in the U.S. Open standing on the 18th tee? Did you know it at the time, or did you confirm it when you got to the green?
I did not know that. I drove it into the heavy rough at 17, just off the fairway, but all it has to do is trickle in a foot, and that's all it did. And I took my 4-wood, and I laid it open and chopped it out to where I think I had a 110-yard second shot or something like, or third shot. And I hit a pretty good shot, probably 10 or 12 feet from the hole. And I remember walking up to the putt thinking, okay, I need to make this to, at best, have a 1-shot lead. At worst, to be even, because I knew I was either in the lead or tied. But to maintain that, I had to make that putt.
Was so that little left or righter?
Yes. It looked like it was about a 60-foot putt and broke about 10 feet, what it looked like. And all downhill.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, when that went in, it was such relief. Then I'm walking to the 18th tee thinking, okay, I think I've got a one.
I think I got it.
Now, Marshall said Fessler just bogeyed 18, so you've got a 2-shot lead. But I think I was wise enough to say, don't believe it. Don't believe something that's not official. It doesn't matter. You've got to put the ball in this fairway, which I did. And then I didn't know I had the lead until I got up to the tee shot, and you could see the big board up at 18. And then I just hit a wonderful 2-iron from there right over the top of the flag and 2-putter from 25 feet.
You probably had about a 1-inch or left, didn't you, to finish it?
Well, I wish I'd have kept that ball. I knew I threw my arm out of socket threw that ball about 100 yards down the fairway, but I wish I kept it. But I was pretty excited.
So that ball never found its way back to you then, huh?
No. I wonder where it is. I'd be curious to know.
Is that the one where you had a vivid dream about winning that Open?
It was. 2 weeks prior. Now, the reality of it and what you have a dream are all different, but the bottom line was that I had, in my dream, I had won the U.S. Open. And, Bruce, I don't know about you or anybody, or the golfers that are listening out there, most of my dreams are frustration dreams. You know, I get the ball in the hole. You know, I've driven down the middle of the fairway, get up there, and it's in a log pile or, you know, something. And But I told my wife, the only person I told, because I didn't want to bite myself on the backside.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, yeah, when I did, it was like, well, you know, dreams do come true. They can come true.
Yeah.
So then in 79, Hale, Inverness was a little bit difficult as well.
It was. It's I think, a very understated golf course. It's not terribly long, but you had to put the ball in the fairway there, as you do on any golf course, but particularly open U.S. Open courses. You had to put the ball there and kind of in the right spot, because the greens were small. They weren't terribly easy to putt, and they did have some challenging holes that you really had to negotiate. Could you make some birdies? Yes. But as we saw at the end of the week, winning score was even par. And what I didn't have a particularly good first round, and I was more concerned about making the cut. So I had a really good second round, and I had an even better third round. I think I may have shot 68, 67, something
67,
like that.
Yeah.
And so going into the last day, in my mind, I thought I had a 5-shot lead. I've told it's a 4-shot lead. I've been told it's a 3-shot lead. It didn't matter. I had a lead that I felt like the most important shot of that day was the drive at the very first hole to get it in the fairway so I could calm the nerves, have a shot to the green, make a solid par or perhaps a birdie, but get out of the box solidly and try to build on that lead. Well, after the, I think it was the 10th hole, I had built that lead to 6 shots. And then as we were going through the back nine, I walked up to the 71st hole, number 17, and I had a 5-shot lead. And I patted myself on the back and said, way to go, you've won another Open. And I went double bogey, bogey. Because I had lost that focus. I had lost the initiative. And boy, did I learn a big lesson there that it's never over till it's over.
Yeah, that that closing 75 tied the post-World War II record for the highest final round score by a winner. But you still won by 2 over Gary Player and Jerry Pate, as you said, at even par. And quite around that third round, 67, I think you matched Watson's eagle on 13. Were you playing with Tom Watson in the third round?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
I don't know. I may have been. I know Tom Weisskopf, he and I were paired together the last round, and I watched him on Saturday make a putt from across the green on 13 for an eagle. And I think he might have been – he was up near the lead. And I may have had the lead. I don't know where I was at the time. But I'm back there on the fairway, and that's a kind of a lumpy little fairway sloping right to left. And I was on the side of a lump. And I thought, you know, heck with that. I'm going to make my own eagle. And I had a 2-iron shot off of this ball up in my face, hit it about a foot from the hole. I made my eagle and went on. But I look back at that shot and just say, you know, of all the shots that I can say, I think that led to the success was that second shot on that hole on the third round.
Just remember the TV coverage. I know it would have been Dave Marr doing the color with Jim McKay, probably on ABC, I guess, then back then. And, you know, you were coming down 18 with that lead, and I think you were in the left greenside bunker, weren't you, on 18?
I stood on that tee shot, or that tee, with a 3-shot lead after my
Yeah, that's right.
Double at 17. But now I know I've lost my thinking because I had been playing 3 wood off the tee, something back in the fairway, hitting a short iron into the green because a very small green. And I thought, oh, I'm just so tired of thinking. Give me the driver. I'm going to hit it down there as close to the green as I can. If I hit it, and I hit it in the right rough. Then I hit it in the left bunker. Now I've got a short side green, and I'm thinking, what are you doing?
I hit a good bunker shot,
but I missed the putt. But after it was all over, I had my family with me. My wife was there with our two kids, young kids. And I remember thinking, this is the first time I've had my family with me at a big event like this and still won. And that's the first thought, is where's my family? Even though it was a bad finish, whose name is on the trophy, guys? That's all I wanted to know. And show me the money.
Literally, as soon as you hit that bunker shot, almost as soon as you made contact, Dave Marr just said something like, well, there it is. You know, once he saw you get up with that fine bunker shot, he said, that's it. It's over.
Well, not that you're ever thinking that, but I just really kicked myself all the way up that hole. Like, what? Why didn't you, with that big a lead, play it back there, play safe? I just was tired of thinking. And, boy, I learned a lot in those two holes on what to do and what not to do.
So for our listeners, just to remember, that was that tournament when Lon Hinkle took the short route on that dogleg number 8, and they planted the Hinkle tree, I think, after the first round there, did they not?
They did, but that didn't deter Lon. He still kept going around it.
He did. And with success, I think, up till maybe the final round. But Bobby Clampett also, I recall, playing as a marker, was escorted off the golf course during the final round. Do you remember anything about that?
I do not.
No, I don't.
And obviously, shenanigans were involved. As a marker, he would have been out in the first group, I suppose. I don't recall the circumstances, but they played very quickly, maybe not exercising due care with every shot. But at some point, the USGA said, all right, that's enough. And they escorted him off the golf course.
Well, I do recall another player who will go nameless, not at an open championship, playing as a marker. And he, too, being escorted off because he was playing shots from off of his knees and now, how would you like to be? Here's a guy clowning around hitting balls off of his knees.
Yeah. Let's jump ahead to win number 3. That was a little closer for me because I was in Chicago at the time. And so I saw plenty of replays of that one. But this was the 1990 win at Medina Country Club in a playoff with Mike Donald. And boy, it took quite an effort after 54 holes just to get in that playoff for you. And then had to make that short putt on 18 to get into playoff, didn't you?
Well, I think.
Yeah, that little
up over that hump on the front of the green.
Yeah.
I have one question before you answer that. You the first one, you nearly threw your shoulder out. Did you nearly break your wrist with the third one?
You know, before the week, I have to go back just a little bit to set the tone, really. I had won the Memorial Tournament in 85, and then I had started my design company. And Bruce, you've designed a lot of courses, and you know that's fun. I really have enjoyed that design part. But it took away some of the focus of playing. So I went 4.5 years of being a participant. I was not a player, and yet I was current winner. I mean, I could play, but I wasn't playing. I sat down in the winter of 1989 after the season was over. I got a yellow pad. I pulled it out and I wrote down the tournaments I had won and thoughts. Okay, that tournament was posture, that alignment. You know, everything I could think about in winning, I wrote down. And if I couldn't think what that was, well, I'd come back to it. Well, oddly enough, when the season started, now I'm starting to think like a player again. Just by virtue of that, I forced myself into, not forced, but it just sort of fell into this thought process that I had some 4.5 years earlier. And I could feel it coming around. So when we got to Medina, I had been invited by the USGA. I didn't qualify in any other category, so I was an invitee. And my goal was don't make their choice look like it was a bad choice. Pretty general, but not specific, because when you look back at the previous 4.5 years, I really hadn't done anything. So I got off to a reasonable start, and after a couple rounds, I'm doing okay. And third round, I'm all right. I'm about an hour behind the leaders. And Billy Ray Brown, who was one of the co-leaders, I believe, comes to me as I'm going to the first tee. He's going to the putting green. And he asks me some advice. And Billy Ray is such a good guy. I really like him. And I said, well, Billy Ray, you're playing well. Just don't beat yourself. You know, hit the shots that you're comfortable hitting, but don't do things stupid. Don't give shots away. And so I'm walking up to the tee, and I'm Greg Norman and I are paired together. And so I'm saying to myself, well, that's pretty good advice. Why don't you try that? I'm talking to myself. Yeah, think about that yourself. Yeah. So we get around. And I'm doing okay, nothing special, but Greg's playing well. He birdies number 10. So we're walking up to the 11th tee, and I'm thinking, well, you know, if he makes a couple more birdies at where he is on the scoreboard, he might have a chance. Who knows? And so I just tried to block it all out. And I looked at the leaderboard on the 11th tee. And so the listeners know, the top 15 get into the next year's tournament. And I was one shot out of the then top 15. So I said, okay, forget about Greg. He's got his deal. Forget about Greg. I've got to play one under here in. And so I went out. I hit two great shots at 11, about 6 feet, birdied it. Okay. Reset the goals. Top 10. I birdied 12. Reset the goals. Top 5. I birdied 13. I don't know how much I can reset the goal. Then birdied 14. Maybe. So I birdied 4 holes in a row. Now I'm one shot back of the then lead. Now, Nick Faldo, Mike Donald, and Billy Ray Brown were the guys that were still kind of vying for the lead. So when I parred 15, 16, 17 there, we get to the tap in at 18, tap in from 45 feet. Why it was such an exciting time, because A, I'd overachieved what I'd set to do, and making a putt from that distance, I never thought it would win outright, ever. And if the best I could possibly get would be a playoff. Now, it would be with whom? So I sat there for an hour watching him come in, and Mike was the guy that was, you know, we had the playoff the next day.
Yeah, Mike still had to make about a 4-footer while you were watching. I think they had split camera, you on one side of the screen and him putting that 3-4-footer on the other. That wasn't an easy putt to get into a playoff.
Well, they never are. They certainly never are. But, you know, I think Mike played, he played the kind of golf that he probably should have won. You know, the way he, I know in the playoff he played very, very well. He was very steady off the tee. He was playing a fairway middle, put it in the fairway. I was making mistakes. And I was 2 down with 3 holes to play. And again, I'm at the 16th hole. And it's a dog leg, sharp dog leg left, and they have concrete discs out in the middle of the fairway, 200 yards, and I'm one step from that concrete disc from the middle of the green. But the pin is on the left side, and there's some trees growing out on the left that where my ball is and where the flag is, those trees just tangentially are on that line. So if I pull it a yard, I'm going to hit the trees. So I've really got to hit a draw around there. It's not the easiest shot in the world. Now, for you, perhaps, Devil, because you played that shot. But anyway, I just hit, another wing foot and 74, 2-iron. Just drew it around there, put it about 6 feet, but made a tough little putt. You know, it broke a lot. It probably broke, you know, 6 inches or so, but I made it. And then, unfortunately for Mike, he bogeyed the last hole. And we went to the first playoff hole, and I hit 2 good shots, made about a 12-footer for a birdie.
Yeah, that was the first hole, plays a little downhill, little dog leg left. Looks like you were hitting like maybe 3 wood off the tee.
4 wood. Yeah.
Or what? I think it was, you probably remember, I was trying to read the sign from the screen. It looked like he was playing about 385 from the USGA post.
Well, it narrowed down pretty. There was no reason to try and hit a driver. If you hit it straight, then you put it into the rough, and it's such a short hole, you're going to hit a fairway wood or an iron and a wedge anyway. I ended up hitting a sand wedge, so it's a four-wood sand wedge. So why take the chance and give yourself the opportunity? And that's what you have to do when you're playing well. And we all know this, that when you're playing well, you think, well, sometimes I can do things that I didn't do yesterday. But again, harkening back to what I did in 74, you take the right way to do it, and the right way is to play it this way.
And you flew it all the way back to the back of that green and I don't know, 7-8 feet? Is that what you had left?
Oh, let's lengthen it to 10 feet.
Okay, let's do that. But made that putt, and I don't know why, but when you got into the playoff with that long putt, we sort of joked about it, but it was a very long putt on 18 up that hill. You can't call it a victory lap, but it was certainly a happy lap. High-fiving the crowd. I'll never forget that.
Well, I won't either because again, I go back to the 11th hole and the goal that I had set for myself. And then as we whittle down the holes, the concentration, the focus that you need to get there and then to be able to do it. And then the release of all of that, when that putt went in the hole, that was a release. And I think the roar of the crowd and the applause and the excitement, it was that little jog over, and I probably touched the hands of 8 or 9 people, and I guarantee you through the year I've touched 500 people.
Yeah.
But it was just an expression of thank you. That's all it was. I didn't know what else to do. I was really jacked up, and that was just a gesture of thanks.
Now, for whatever reason, I've got in my mind that happened not once but twice, and maybe it was because of all the news replays I saw when I was living in Chicago, but I could have sworn that after you won, you did another victory lap.
The next week in Westchester.
There you go.
It was back to back, but it was more of a, that one was planned. If I won, then I'd
a little put on.
I just, okay, if this is what it's going to be, then let's keep the show on the road.
Yeah, that was terrific. Well, that sort of takes us through the 3 U.S. Open wins for Hale Irwin. Of course, there's a lot more to the Hale Irwin story that we want to tell, and we will at some point. But Hale, you've been very gracious with your time today. Thanks for getting us started with your story. And Bruce Devlin, this has been fun.
It has been fun. And as I mentioned at the start of this segment, here's a man that's won 83 tournaments around the world. Some people have called him a bulldog. He's a hard worker. He never quit, as he said today on our little telecast. And we thank you, Hale, for your time today. And we look forward to chatting with you in the future.
Well, I look forward to it. And you know, I've got the greatest respect in the world for all those guys and ladies that have been out there pioneering before me and those that have followed in the footsteps. It's a fabulous game. It has provided me. And the trophies are wonderful. The money's even better. But more than anything else, the real treasure is the people that you get to meet around the world. How would I ever get to some of these places and meet the people that I've been able to meet had it not been for the game of golf? So to that end, I'm eternally thankful.
Thanks a lot, Hale, for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
It started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for 2, but it bounced off 9. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.